Okay, so maybe welcome everyone. Anyway, I will start with the first two or three slides will be sort of like entertaining, as is often done here. So for the latecomers, they will not miss anything essential, I guess. So my name is Andreas Fucsik. I am from the Johannes Kepler University in Linz. And I am from training a statistician, but in recent years I cooperated a lot with population geneticists, especially also with Christian. And what I am telling you here is to a large extent addressing some questions that made me think about this in more detail when I cooperated with him. So my first slide claims that evolution did not give us a good intuition to deal with probability. So that's actually quite well known. So people who are really not trained in probability or mathematics often have a hard time to judge things as random or not random, and also to make decisions about taking risks, for instance. So they sometimes misjudge risks, and if you look at this slide, you see the points to the left and the right, and if you have some training in probability, you probably recognize that the really random one is the left one, and the right one is just the two regular one.
Do you have your mic?
Closer to me. Okay, is it better now?
It's for posterity.
Okay, it's for posterity.
Is it also on? It'll switch on. Say it's on top, says mute or.
Yeah, it's on, yeah. Thank you. So the right one is just too regular in order to be random, and actually there is a. Field of mathematics, which is called Forza Monte Carlo, and they deal with constructing such patterns that are more uniform than you would expect by randomness, but pure randomness would be the left one. So as it's difficult for us to judge what is random and what is really maybe a signal or so, it's helpful to rely on mathematics so you can compute this. And also on statistics, when we are talking about actual data. So statistics, maybe for this evolutionary reason, is a fairly young science. If you think about mathematics as a field, first efforts in mathematics date back quite some time ago. So I took this picture because it's apparently a trigonometry table. I cannot read it, but it was found to date back to approximately 1700 before Christ, and from Mesopotamia, and apparently trigonometry has a very long history, given this table. Obviously, you could also think about the ancient Greeks and their efforts in mathematics, but for statistics, you can claim that statistics more or less originated in the 20th century, given basing on the probabilistic background that was developed before, although you could argue, it's also this book does, History of Statistics Before 1900, that there were some statistical results and achievement also before. If you think about the normal distribution, dating back to Gauss and Laplace, for instance. So there was, of course, already some work and some results before, but mostly statistics developed as a field in the 20th century when probability was there as a basis. And nowadays, statistics, as you know, is very important in the, well, more or less all branches of science, because it helps you to get your paper published, because you have to convince your the reviewers that your results are not just noise, but there is really a signal. So, and statistics tries to help with this and distinguish signals from noise. And will be dealing with statistical methods, as already indicated in my title in the context of experimental evolution. And I think already Molly had this slide with experimental evolution in different hosts and species in different environments. This is a nice review paper by Tony and others. What's maybe worth mentioning here is that depending on the species, in view of the statistical modeling, different aspects of the data are more relevant and other aspects are less relevant. For instance, in higher organisms, you have usually much smaller effective population sizes, so drift plays a more important role. And you have longer generation time, so your signal maybe not as strong. So for statistical modeling, it makes a difference what type of organism you're working with. So I will focus on experimental evolution on higher organisms, as for instance, Drosophila. Here this slide shows you a like cartoon of Drosophila evolve and resequence experiment. Where you keep flies for a certain number of generations, here T generations, under controlled experimental conditions, and you measure changes in allele frequency to see if some adaptation, for instance, to selection pressures also is going on. And you can have maybe this nice garden type environment, so you can have simple bottles, as we have heard already in this meeting. And for the statistical analysis, this makes less of a difference, but for the interpretation, obviously, it does. So now let me start with this picture. And this picture is taken from a paper by Griffin et al., appearing in 2017. And this picture is coming from a statistical analysis on their data on experimental evolution of Drosophila. They had five control populations to the left and five treatment populations to the right. And the treatment populations were exposed to desiccation, so they looked at adaptation in terms of desiccation resistance. So if you look at these plots, so these are Manhattan plots. On the x-axis, you have the position of your SNP. And on the y-axis, you have minus the logarithm base 10 of the p-value. And then you have an acceptance cutoff here marked by a dotted line, which is hard to see, but the points exceeding the acceptance cutoff are marked in red, so you can see basically where you have some signals. And so what they found is basically that you see many more significant SNPs in the treatment than you have in your control. You have also heterogeneity between the treatment populations. For instance, population 3 and 4 show many more significant SNPs than the other replicates. And also what you can see is the signal is not, maybe partially, but often not consistent across replicates. So for instance, if you look at these two replicates, here you have a high peak, whereas here you exceed the rejection threshold by a much smaller, to a much smaller extent. So how did we how did they come up with this analysis? How was this done? And if you look at what they have been doing, is they looked at three criteria. The first one, significant results with Fisher's exact test plus Bonferroni correction. The second one is significant likelihood ratio test for allele frequencies in the two populations. And the third one is they looked at the 95% confidence interval obtained from drift simulations. And if all these criteria were satisfied, so you got significance in all of these three criteria, then your candidate SNP would be selected as significant or differentially expressed. But on the other hand, they apparently also had some doubts about their statistical analysis, because they stated in their discussion, determining the statistical optimum correction approach for a Poulsen experiment is an important methodological research question as yet unanswered. So they were maybe not entirely sure if they did the analysis of the data correctly. So we might ask the question, well, were this data analyzed correctly, or were there problems with this data analysis? So for this, actually, to answer this question, we should first look at the sources of variation, because a proper modeling of or analysis of such data needs to take into account all the sources of variations we have. So one source of variation is the pool sequencing. The next one is the sampling. So they sampled 50 flies for the sequencing each generation. And the third source of variation is genetic drift. So here are numbers. These numbers are the effective population sizes estimated by the authors of this paper. And the problem with the approach they took actually is that none of these criteria considered all sources of variation simultaneously. So why is this a problem? Well, this is maybe a bit oversimplified, but basically all these sources of variation add up and add to some, well, total variation. And basically you get, in order to get something significant, you basically, your data have to jump over these total variations. So the signal.
I'm going to turn the light on for the board. Maybe
this side. Okay, so the signal has to be stronger as the total variation is something like I can jump over this large obstacle. So what they did instead actually is with their criteria, they cut the large obstacle into three pieces and tried to jump over these three pieces separately, which is apparently, or which is obviously much simpler. So the first piece is the significant result with Fisher's exact test. So if you use Fisher's exact test or chi-square test or something like this for this matter, it's designed for comparing two samples with respect to their success probability, or say to their minor allele frequency in genetic terms. So this one takes just care of the last source of variation, the pool sequencing step, because this considers this noise. So maybe they had some doubts about this. So maybe as a sort of penitence, or just because they didn't want to have the whole genome as significant, you can see here that the cutoff point here is something like 10 to the power negative 12. So if you think about the Bonferroni correction, and if you take the number of SNPs to be, like in their experiment, they had a bit more than 2 million SNPs, so something like 2 times 10 to the power 6. So if you would use a usual cutoff level of alpha of 0.05 or 0.01, something like this, you would end up with a cutoff by Bonferroni, which is roughly 10 to the power negative 8, or if you take minus log 10, you would have here a cutoff of 8 approximately. So why did they have a cutoff of 30? Well, they choose not the usual alpha of 0.1, they choose an alpha of 10 to the power negative 6. So obviously the whole field of medicine would be very jealous if you have such a strict error control. You would say, okay, the chance of having even one incorrect significant SNP is 10 to the power negative 6, so it's less than a million. So it's obviously a quite unusually strong error control they applied here. So basically what they did for the first obstacle, they increased the error control to make it somewhat higher. How about the second test? Well, they programmed the likelihood ratio test proposed in a paper by Lynch and al. In 2014. Looked if whether this test is significant. And in this paper, I mean, if you read even the abstract, you see this likelihood ratio test compares two populations, sees if the allele frequency change is the same in two populations under pool sequencing and sampling from the populations. So basically, this test takes this one and stacks it on top of the other one, so it would give this obstacle, but it still doesn't consider genetic drift because it just compares whether two populations have exactly the same allele frequency. Well, and the last one with this confidence intervals, they tried to take care of the genetic drift, so they took the third obstacle. And basically what they noticed, well, they present here in the table the results just based on the first criteria, claiming that the first one was the most stringent. So apparently the Bonferroni control was so strict so that this first obstacle tended to be the highest. But still, this is obviously sort of like ad hoc approach, and you don't really have statistical error control with this. It's basically not much better than taking the top 10 or top 50 peaks or something like this and see looking for the strongest signal. So it's obviously not the best thing to do. So the question is this just a question of finding the right threshold? So should it not be maybe 10 to the power negative 12? Should it be maybe if we take all this on top, one of top of this other, should it be maybe 10 to the power negative 15 or maybe negative 20 or something like this? Didn't they reach the right cutoff? And actually this is a bit more subtle than this, because what they did, if you look at it mathematically, you can see this formula. So this is the classical chi-square test, which does more or less the same as Fisher's exact test in this context, what they use. And if you write down Fisher's chi-square test, you can write it down in different ways. And this way of writing down the chi-square test is not the usual one you see in the textbooks, but it's equivalent. So this is just gives you the chi-square test. And if you look at the formula, what you have is you take the square difference between the allele frequencies at the two time points and divides by the estimated variance of this squared difference. And if you do a little bit of algebra, you see that these two terms give you the estimated variance of this difference. So, but this variance, obviously, just take the poolsec part of the variation into account. I took the sample sizes here, N0 and NTR, and R is the number of reads in your pool sequencing experiment. So you have just this component of variance. So, but if you do a little bit of algebra, obviously you could also divide not only by this component of variance, but divide by the estimated total variance. And if you compute the estimated total variance, you would come up with this formula for a chi-square test that takes into account the total variance for each SNP. So this contains the poolsec variance, depending on the number of reads, the sampling variance, depending on the sample size at both time points, and at the later time points, also the drift variance, depending on the effective population size, NE. Obviously, at the first time point, you don't have drift yet, so you have the drift variance only in the second component of variance. So this would be a chi-square test or an approximation which takes care of the total variance and which would give you appropriate p-values, obviously depending on how good you estimate your effective population size, for instance. So this is still an issue, of course. Now going back to the question we had, So if this is the right formula for the test, can we come up with an better appropriate cutoff? So basically, take these original p-values obtained from your chi-square or Fisher's exact test, and can we use this formula to obtain the cutoff? Asking these questions is equivalent to saying, okay, I have the correct variance in my chi-square test, and this would then be the cutoff point, which is the quantile of the chi-square distribution with 1 degree of freedom, 95% quantile if you have 5% error probability. Can I find a constant gamma such that gamma times this quantile would be an appropriate cutoff? So if you do a little bit of algebra, you can compute this constant gamma, but the problem you have is that this constant depends on the sample sizes, the number of reads at two time points, and the effective population sizes. So all these quantities in your model depend on the constant gamma. This constant gamma depends on all these quantities, and so the problem now you have is that actually this correction of the chi-square test will be different for each SNP you have, because each SNP will have typically different numbers of reads, even if the sample size and the NE is assumed to be the same across trip. SNPs, the number of reads will still be typically different. So this constant depends on the number of reads in your Pulsic experiment. So this is actually then a problem, because this implies you cannot just modify this cutoff level. You have to do a modification, or would have to do a modification individually for each SNP, or phrased in a different way, you could also, instead of looking at this cutoff value, adjust your p-values. The p-value adjustment would have to be different for each SNP, so this means the relative position of the SNPs in this plot will change. So if you just do a simple chi-square test, you don't get the relative positions of your SNP.
Are the variations in the read number of reads so large that this is really important, that you need to treat them differently?
Well, in this Pulsec, typically yes. So for instance, if you have like this experiment, the average number of reads, I will come to this, was different among replicates. It was something like 40 or 50 per position. And if you think about this as like Poisson distribution, you can easily, they had some positions where they had several thousand reads, and some positions where they only had 10 reads or something like this. So there was still quite a bit of difference. Yeah. And this actually can then change the relative positions of your SNPs, and which means this plot will not be qualitatively correct. So it's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or you could just use your test, right?
Yeah, you could use your test to get basically, and then you can use a common cutoff if you use this new chi-square test or so, this modified chi-square test. But with the original chi-square test, you will not get the relative positions of the SNPs correct. And furthermore, there is, as I mentioned already, the coverage in the sequencing experiments varied from between control and treatment, and also between the different treatment positions. And if you look at the treatment replicates, then the replicate 3 and 4 had a particularly high average coverage. So like 70 and 75, here it's only 23. And if you look back at the original analysis, what you see is that this correlates very much with the amount of significant results you get. So for replicate 3 and 4, you get many, many significant results, whereas for 2, you get barely any. And if you think about what tested did, well, they just used the chi-square or Fisher's exact test, and if you have a small sample size in this test, you have a lower power than if you have, lower power than if you have a larger sample size or a larger read coverage. But as this is not reflecting the actual variance, because we neglect the drift variants and the sampling variants, this does not, so these significant results do not appropriately reflect the difference in evidence. And as I will show you a bit later, actually, if you do the analysis correctly, you will see that these differences between these replicants largely disappear. So basically, all these replicants will have about the same amount of evidence. And if you look at treatment and control, well, these two also have much smaller average numbers of reads, so sequence coverage. And this is not always the case. So for instance, if you look at the first replicate here and here, the sequence coverage is more or less the same, but still this replicant had fewer significant SNPs than you got here. And, sorry, it's the wrong direction. Other explanation could be that explanation for this effect is that according to the estimates from the paper, the effective population size is higher for the control than for the treatment. So you have less drift variance in the control than in the treatment. So basically less chance to get spurious significant results if you don't take care for drift variants in your test. So basically, this mostly these factors can mostly explain, as I will show you in some graphs a bit later, the differences between the treatment replicates and the difference in the amount of significant results between treatment and control. So anyway, if we do it properly, want to do this analysis properly in such a two time point setup, what we can do is first we do approximate testing using this variance estimate in the chi-square test I showed you. So estimating the total variance in just then compared to just taking the variance from pool sequencing. Or, of course, you could do simulations. But then, of course, if you do simulations, you also have to do it correctly, because as this also implies, if I just take simulations from a null model without selection, with just sequencing and sampling and drift, I can just take all my simulation runs, maybe with different coverage or so, and just take one cutoff level obtained from looking at all these simulation runs simultaneously, because the correct cutoff level, as I told you, will depend on the ratio or the relative magnitude of all of these ends of all of these sample sizes. So if you do simulations and you want to do it correctly, you would have to do it separately for different pool sig coverages, if you assume that the all sampling variance and NE is the same across your simulations. So if you do it all together and having just one common cutoff of, again, would not take the relative magnitude of effects into account correctly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bigger question. Is there any reason to do this in a frequentist way instead of a Bayesian way? Because it's getting very complicated to make it into a frequentist problem. Maybe this is just my Bayesian prejudice. It's like, if I'm going to do simulations, why wouldn't I do ABC or something like that?
I think if you do it in a Bayesian way and you want to do it properly in the Bayesian way, honestly speaking, it doesn't get easier. Because if frequentist or Bayesian, you will not get the around taking all these components of variance into account properly.
But you said if I run simulations, why wouldn't I do some? I'm asking as a complete outsider. I mean, this must be some debate that's running in the field, because it always is. I'm just curious.
Eventually comes down to computational time and things don't converge, and you spend a lot of time rerunning it.
Yeah, I mean, of course you can do. I don't see I mean, first of all, here, if you just want to measure evidence, I don't see really the advantage of doing it in Bayesian way. Of course, you could look at base factors, which is commonly done. But in the base factors, if you think about this, also the prior distribution comes in. So you would need some prior distribution of your selection coefficients and all of this. And the question is if you can come up with reasonable estimates or reasonable choices of these prior distributions. Even if you do this and your Bayesian analysis is proper, well, then I don't see that this would be easier or faster to do it in a Bayesian way. I would rather say it would be, your model will be more complicated because you have to take care of more parameters. You have to model the parameters under the null and the alternative model. And I don't think that this would get easier if you do it in Bayesian way. But I'm not, don't understand me wrongly, I'm not against doing it in a Bayesian way. But in principle, my feeling is if you do it in a Bayesian way, you have to address exactly the same problems as you have here. Because if you neglect that there's drift variance or sampling variance, you will again get misleading results, even if you do it in a Bayesian way. It doesn't help you. Mm-hmm. So the proper and the point I wanted to make here is the proper modeling, and maybe you could also say I am dealing here with this in a frequentist way because it took me less time to do it in the frequentist way, I must say, honestly. And this was also done in a frequentist way, so and I just wanted to show how to do this analysis in a better way.
So. Mm-hmm. Honest, as an honest, honest question, that if you're going to simulate complicated models, then
yeah, but obviously, if you could also, if you like, you could also do it in a Bayesian way if you address the problems or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the goal is to infer selection or some form of or some deviation from drift.
At least here in this paper, yeah.
In a single replicate, realization of the evolutionary process. So.
Well, that's what they basically did here in this graph.
My question is, traditionally, you just put all the replicates together, so there's an extra level in which basically the variance among.
I will come to this. I will discuss this, how you to combine the evidence across your replicate. So I will discuss this, yeah. Obviously, that's a valid question. I mean, just to address your question very quickly, one problem with just combining the replicates here or, say, adding up the log p values or whatever you want to do is that the signals are not consistent across the replicates here. So what you can see here is, for instance, at this position here, you have a large spike, but here is not that large. And on the other hand, so if you look at the signal, so here the signal is much larger than here. Here it's not present at all.
But I guess my question is that even though you could be explicit at modeling drift variance within a replicate,
yes,
it's not clear to me that that drift variance should not be modeled as the among replicate variance that you get during the experiment.
So you're saying you have different.
If that happens. So it's unclear to me that that you can interpret basically one data point as a deviation from one the expected drift variance as the selection.
Yes, I mean in principle, of course, you could try to do this, but if you want to find the selected one, you have to. And you take the variance across the replicates, you have to exclude the selected position somehow. And
to estimate NE.
The drift, yes, the NE, because, yeah.
For sure, but it's a more basic question. At a given position, if you're asking the question, is this position being selected under this regime, if you find that two out of three replicates do not show it, so what's your conclusion? Even if you're modeling that it's the drift variance as your, is it selected or not?
I mean, it's a good question, and I think Christian, yeah? Hmm?
Yeah, it's all a molecular evolution, right? One chimp, one human.
Yeah, so I mean, if you look at the authors of
that
the...
That seems to be a very heuristic way of doing things.
But it's all a real evolution.
Yeah, so basically...
But it could all be by drift, even if you're modeling the drift variant.
Well, if you're modeling it, the drift variance correctly, and you get your significant results, it should not be by drift. Give me a model is correct, right? But I will address this problem of inconsistency between replicates a bit later. I have slides on this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an important issue, I think, and I think it merits discussion, so it should be discussed. But let me first start with go to something simpler. For getting this right, we have to estimate the effective population size, the NE. And again, if you estimate NE, you have to take all sources of variation into account properly, because you don't have only drift in your data. You have also, again, sequencing noise and sampling in your data. And this picture is from a paper we had recently, where we look at this, and what you see is the green and the blue box plots show the behavior of two popular estimates of an E from the literature. One is from Waples and one from Forde and Ryman. And here the effective, these are simulated data. Effective population size is 100, and here you see the estimates. And what you see is a clear bias in the estimates, both from Waples and Kurde and Ryman. And why do they have this bias? Well, they don't take all sources of variation into account. They just take drift and sampling into account, but not the noise due to pool sequencing. So they cannot deal with pool sequencing. So basically, we developed a modified estimator of an E that also takes pool sequencing into account. And if you do this, as you see, then your estimates are quite well centered close to the true NE, so we get much better estimates. And basically, to understand this, so if you neglect, yeah?
The simulations are all neutral.
They are all neutral, yeah. So if you neglect the Poulsen step in the variance, basically you underestimate your, or so your total variance actually is bigger than the variance just under drift and sampling alone. And this additional variance is then added up to the drift variance. Basically, what you do is in these approaches, you take the total variance, subtract the sampling variance, and what remains is the drift variance. So if you forget to subtract also the Poulsen variance, you have an upward biased estimate of your drift variance, and which means your NE estimate will be downward biased. So what you can see in the blue one, the green one is a bit more difficult because here you are downward biased, but towards the end you are upward biased if you go along with the number of generations. But the reason for this is that they used an approximation in their estimates for an E, which only works well for small numbers of generations, but not so good for larger numbers of generations. And so therefore, this additional error compensates or somewhat overcompensates the amount or the error introduced by neglecting the sequencing variance in the first stages. Anyway, maybe if you are lucky and they use the estimator similar to this Waples estimator, they had in their experiment 13 generations between base population and involved, and maybe with 13 generations, maybe these two errors mostly cancel out and actually they end up with some something unbiased. But obviously this is just due to luck that they chose the right number of generations and not by doing it with an appropriate method. So how did we correct this? We basically looked at two sampling plans. One is where the sample is taken from the population before reproduction and not returned, and the other one is taken after reproduction or returned to the sample, and these two sampling plans make slight difference in how to estimate NE. Don't want to go too much into detail here. So the basic idea is, as well known from population genetics, the variance of the allele frequency at time t, so after evolving t generations, divided by the standard deviation of the initial allele frequencies, is given by this formula. And so you have the NE here, and then what we call method of moments estimate in statistics. Idea to estimate NE is then just plug in an estimate for this variance here and solve the whole thing for NE, which is done. So if you would know your population allele frequencies at the two time points exactly, you could just take these population allele frequencies xi and yi and divide by xi times 1 minus xi, mimicking this formula for this. So if you don't know the population allele frequencies, but have the frequencies only from your Poulsen experiment, you have to replace these quantities by estimates. So you have estimates in the numerator and denominator, and it turns out if you replace the denominator here by this quantity and set I hat is the average of xi and yi, you get something which has the same expectation as this one. The expectation is p0 times 1 minus p0, but this gives you slightly less variation, so it's maybe bit more accurate estimator. So what we do is basically computing expectations of ratios is a bit difficult, so we approximate this expectation by taking expected values in numerator and denominator separately. And when we and we take these expected values, assuming that there is pool sequencing plus sampling plus genetic drift, so all components of variance. And if you have these formulas, you figure out what are the right correcting constants to get rid of the noise due to pool sequencing and sampling. And these are just the right normalizing constants, and you use again the method of moments estimator. So basically, the idea is fairly simple. So maybe the question is, how well does it work in practice? So these NE estimators are many cases fairly accurate, but in some cases not so. As you can see, this is the coefficient of variation. So you want the relative error of your estimates, and you see these relative errors tend to be high if the number of generations is small, and this p is the pool size for pool sequencing, and so this p is the one. Sorry, I'm not completely sure. No? One of them is the sample size, and the other one is the size of the pool you have in pool sequencing. Sorry, no. One is the sample size, and the other one is the average number of reads if you have in your pool sequencing experiment. So, I'm just thinking which one is which, but actually it does not matter that much, because the pattern is if the drift variation is small compared to the noise due to sequencing plus sampling, then the estimates get more inaccurate, because what you subtract from the total variance is the expected variance due to sequencing and sampling. And if this is large, small quantity remains. And as the true variance due to pool sequencing and sampling is only approximated by the expected frequency, So we make an error in this approximation. So we don't correct by the exact quantity, but by an estimate of this exact quantity. So and these errors turn out to have a higher influence if these errors have a large relative magnitude compared to the remaining signal. So this is the basic idea, actually. So in this case, we are less inaccurate. And this happens if you have few generations, because then the drift variance is still small. So the drift signal is not so large already. And if at the same time you have maybe small read coverage and or small sample sizes, these two quantities will have a large influence. And therefore, it's hard to get accurate estimates in such cases. What we also did is we looked at local estimation of NE. As you know, NE is affected, for instance, by selection. And what you see in the top plot, just showing you briefly, is we did a window-based approach. And for each window, we estimated NE separately. What you see is a large amount of fluctuation between windows. And then, we, of course, the question is, again, what part of this fluctuation is just noise? So it's like estimation error. And where is the signal? So to figure this out, we combined these estimates with so-called segmentation approach. So this is a method where you estimate the piecewise constant function, so NE, and you have to decide where to go up and go down. So how many jumps do you have in this function? So how often the NE changes across your chromosome? And this method is supposed, except for a small error probability alpha, not to include more jumps than actually present in the real signal, so in the real NE. So basically, this is sort of like a parsimonious estimate of changes in NE. And I mean, these are not the same data I showed you before. These are data from Christian's lab. And what you see is that actually across the chromosomes, there seems to be actually some variation in NE. Yeah.
So the bottom is just like classic change point analysis kind of statistics, or is something more genetic based?
I would say it's modern change point analysis statistics. So these methods used here are about 6 or 7 years old, if you look at the literature. So it's
but they're notoriously hard to estimate, right? Like they're very flat directions if you do maximum likelihood, at least.
Yeah.
Right?
So yeah.
So how seriously can I take this?
Well,
orders of magnitude.
Yeah. In some sense, I would say at least it should give you, I mean, this approach should give you a parsimonious solution. So it should not, unless there's clear statistical evidence, it should not give you too many change points or so, too many jumps or so. Maybe the true signal has more changes in an E than you see here. In some sense, you're, in this case, you're in the safe side. Yeah. Anyway, so.
The issue with that E, right, is that E is a metric of the extent of drift and inbreeding in the population, right? And you're sort of going back and to estimate an E. You're saying that it's heterogeneous across the genome. That doesn't make much sense.
Right? Well, what should I say? There seems to be, at least with this data, some statistical evidence of heterogeneity for what?
How do we interpret the lower NE in an autosomal chromosome?
Selection. Yeah, maybe balancing selection.
Then the concept of NE doesn't make sense.
So the question, yeah, I mean, it's well known that selection affects NE, of course, also balancing selection, for instance. And in some sense, of course, the question is how you interpret NE under selection. That's the point you want to make.
I believe that there are a couple of other alternatives. One is just don't think about NE selection and just say how much it has differentiated between ancestral and derived states, and then only use those markers to estimate NE as you're doing. And the second one is completely, it's a completely alternative method, or independent method, which is you measure, in the case of fruit flies, both the male mating success and female mating reproductive success, and then you just use classical genetics to estimate the expected animal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that there are not other approaches. I mean, you could do it another way. I mean, concerning your point is selection or so, what we, of course, want for our statistical test then is the neutral NE. And the question is if some of these NE estimates are under neutral and some under selection. So my idea here would be actually to take something like the median or even a lower percentile of your NE estimates to be on the safe side, because if you underestimate NE, you are on the safe side. And if you believe that, say, less than half of your genome is under selection, or at least less than a quarter of the genome is under selection, taking these lower quantiles will not be affected by the other NE estimates under selection. So. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So Michael threw out a model last week that was maybe there's hundreds of loci of small effect, you know, which I think you could in some systems with large population sizes you could become enamored with the model like that. Then because these selection's strong and will generate LD in these experiments, there might be no neutral region, right? I mean, that's at least if that model were correct-ish, everything's kind of moving around, you know, especially as populations get big, right?
Yeah, but on the other hand, this means that you would underestimate NE if you include loci under selection, so which means that you lose power in your test. So basically, you would overestimate drift variance, and you would maybe find fewer significant results, but it would not compromise at least your significance level. But yeah, it can of course be an issue. If you have nothing which is neutral, then where are your data to estimate neutral in E? So I think time is going quickly. So I wanted to show you a bit about how doing multiple testing correctly, and the other thing was how to deal with signals that are differing between replicates, or how to combine signals across replicates. So I don't know if you have time for both talk about in detail, but maybe you just tell me what you're interested more in. Or
just go ahead.
Okay, just go ahead. So basically, what they used in their paper we have just seen was the Bonferroni method. Probably you all know about this. Bonferroni controls the family-wise error, which is the probability to having one or more false rejections. So Bonferroni test controls this. One advantage is it works under any kind of dependence. You don't have to worry about linkage or whatever. But it's also known or believed to be very conservative, which is true in some cases, but might be also interesting to look at it in a more detailed way. It's actually surprisingly accurate for independent test statistics. So if you don't have linkage, so everything would be independent, then the probability of having one or more errors using the Bonferroni correction is just 1 minus the probability of making no error at level alpha over n, if you have n tests using the Bonferroni correction. If n is large, then you can approximate this by e to the power negative alpha. And it should be should be 1 minus e to the power negative alpha. I dropped the 1, yeah. And this is, if you do a Taylor expansion, alpha plus order of alpha squared. So the error you make in your error probability is just of order alpha squared. And if alpha is typically chosen small, like 5% or 1%, the error you make is actually not that big. But having said this, you can still become less conservative by relaxing your error constraints. You can look at the force discovery rate, which is the expected value of force rejections given your number rejections. If you don't reject anything, you define this ratio to be zero, which is actually necessary. Otherwise, you cannot control force discovery rate under all scenarios. And you can show with the simple derivation that force discovery rate is always smaller or equal than the family-wise error. So everything that controls family-wise error will also control force discovery rate, but not in the other direction. And the most popular procedure for controlling the force discovery rate is probably this Benjamini-Hochberg procedure, where you sort your p-values, p1 up to pm, according to magnitude. You have for each p-value a corresponding null hypothesis. Then you compute k as the maximum I, such that the I smallest p-value doesn't exceed I over m times alpha. If this does not exist, if the set is empty, you don't reject anything. But if it's non-empty, you reject these k null hypotheses. I show you a short animation where you have 100 hypotheses. In 90, is the null hypothesis is true. In 10, the alternative. Here you have all of your logarithm p-values. And here, as these are simulated data, we know the truth. Here they are the null p-values. Here are the alternative p-values. And if you look at this, you see that actually at the beginning, the rejection of Bonferroni and Benjamini-Hochberg is the same. And as the alternatives become stronger, or say the signal in the alternatives becomes stronger, I simulated alternative p-values and increased the signal in the alternative p-values. So they move to the right, the negative logarithm of the p-value, so the evidence gets smaller. So at one point, I don't know if you saw it, this jumps, and suddenly you can reject something with Benjamini-Hochberg, which you could not reject with Bonferroni. So there's an intermediate phase where you can reject more with Benjamini-Hochberg than with just Bonferroni. And at the end, if the signal gets very strong, then both basically can reject everything, and there's again no difference between the methods. So here's a second example, which is actually quite instructive, I would say. Now what I did is I increased the number of hypotheses, 1,800 null and 200 alternatives, still few in view if you look at genomic data. And what I also did is I made the alternative signals closer together, so there was less variation in the alternative. And what you see now is at the end, Bonferroni rejects just the wrong null hypothesis, so the true alternatives, whereas Benjamini-Hochberg also rejects a bunch of true null hypotheses, which is of course okay, because 5% false discoveries are okay, and we are controlling the false discovery rate. But what is maybe more interesting, you can see in the next slide, and here we stop this previous animation at the point where Benjamini-Hochberg starts to give you something significant, which is at this point. So you have this signal strength. So here, obviously, Bonferroni couldn't reject anything. Benjamini-Hochberg could reject the true alternatives, plus a couple of null hypotheses. What you can also see here is that the largest log p-values were those from the null hypothesis and not those from the alternative hypothesis. So this means if you want to have FDR control and you get a couple of rejections, and then there's, you maybe say, well, these are too many candidate SNPs, and I don't want to deal with that many, and just I take, say, the top three or top four, something like this, then this would actually not control your false discovery rate. So if you take the best ones, we have to take everything that is rejected by Benjamini Hochberg to actually control the false discovery rate. So if you just take the top signals, this would not control the false discovery rate. Here, this would be all false discoveries. Obviously, the false discovery rate is the expectation, but at least there are scenarios where taking the top does not control the false discovery rate. This depends, of course, also on the choice of parameters and other things. But in general, you should be careful. And then there is this Q value, which is based on the idea of estimating the false discovery rate, or rather the positive false discovery rate. So the idea here is, if I want to estimate the false discovery rate instead of controlling it, you are not interested in estimating it when you discovered nothing. So therefore, you look at this ratio given, you rejected at least one null hypothesis, because otherwise it's not interesting. So, and then in order to get good estimates, as usual, we need a sufficient amount of data. So we replace this expected, if we have sufficient amount of data, so the hope is that we can replace this expected value by the empirical quantity, false rejections divided by rejections. The problem you have, you know how many hypotheses you have rejected, but you don't know the number of false rejections, because obviously you don't know in advance which null hypotheses are false. So you have to estimate somehow the numerator, and you can estimate it by the total number of null hypotheses times alpha. Alpha is the error probability if you have uniform p-values. Well, you also don't know this m0, so you have to somehow estimate the proportion of true null hypotheses in your data, and this is the idea of the q-value. On the next slide, I show you how to estimate this p0. And now, so, now, if you now have this positive false discovery rate, which is now P0 times M times gamma, sorry, so I changed here the alpha to a gamma, because I want to now have this positive false discovery rate at an arbitrary level gamma. So gamma could be equal to alpha or not equal to alpha. So just take an arbitrary gamma. Basically, you take this here, and plug in the gamma instead of the alpha. And once you have this quantity, you can get the Q value by plugging in the original P values for this gamma, so which gives you the estimated false discovery rate if you would reject all P values PI that are gamma or smaller. So this is the basic idea behind this. So here you can, this is the idea to estimate the proportion of true null hypotheses. So basically, you think that mostly you get very large p-values in cases where the null hypothesis is true, something like 0.8 or 0.9 or very close to 1. So you just take the proportion of p-values that are quite large, larger than 1 minus alpha, and divided by the expected proportion. And this would be this ratio. Obviously, you might also get a few alternatives here, so you overestimate a little bit here, but this again puts you on the safe side, so you are a bit pessimistic here. This approach going back to a story in the early 2000s. And here you have a toy example now for these Q values. So I took the previous plot and added two new rows, the Q values under the null hypothesis and the Q values under the alternative hypothesis. And what you can see is, so this orange line is basically all Q values that are smaller than your significance threshold alpha equal 0.05. This red line is the cutoff if you use Benjamini Hochberg, and the black one is from Bonferroni. And what you can see is sort of like the story, the Q value is the most liberal, you get the most rejections or also the most false rejections here. But it's still actually okay if you take the false discovery proportion. So this is the empirical proportion of false discoveries. You get with story 0.063, which is reasonably close to 0.05. And Benjamini-Hochberg is just one order of magnitude smaller. So it's stricter in the sense that it really wants to control the false discovery rate under all circumstances and not only estimating it. So, but, yeah, maybe go further in case of time. One important problem is false discovery rate under dependence. There, if you have dependent data, so for instance, linkage, Benjamini-Hochberg is more or less okay. So there is mathematical results that if your data are not independent, but positively regression dependent, which means if one of the test statistics under the null is more extreme, the other tend to be more extreme too. So it's sort of like positive correlation. It's still okay, so you control your false discovery rate. You would get problems if you have negative correlation, actually. There's also another procedure, it's called Benjamini-Jacutielli procedure, which is a slight modification of Benjamini-Hochberg, where you divide the alpha by this sum, which is approximately log m, actually, and with Benjamini-Jacutielli, you would can show that you can control the false discovery rate under any type of dependence. So this is the price for the control under any type dependence of dependence. Here, if again a simulation under dependence, and I want to point your attention to that the Q values become very noisy under dependence. So whereas Benjamini-Hochberg is still okay, the estimated false discovery rate gets problems. Here I simulated data with 900 null hypotheses and 100 alternatives, and I simulated now the null hypothesis as being dependent. Basically, I simulated 10 independent copies and repeated each of these independent copies 100 times. So basically, you have there 10 pieces of independent information, and the rest is within these independent blocks, everything is perfectly dependent. So this was the simulation. And what you get here is actually the false discovery proportion you observe with this Q-value approach was between 50 and 100%, so it was actually very big. So what is the idea behind this? So basically, this ratio will become quite noisy under dependence. Because if you don't have enough independent estimation, estimating this expected value by the empirical quantity is just inaccurate. I mean, just think about the case where you have all your p-values under null hypothesis to be perfectly correlated. So they would be exactly equal. This means either you reject nothing from your null hypothesis, or you reject everything from your null hypothesis, which means your false discovery proportion will be either 0% or 100%, and then it depends on your luck if you're in the 0% case or in the 100% case. And this case where the false discovery proportion was actually fairly high was a situation where at the beginning, one Q value under the null was close to the 0.05 rejection boundary. But if you have 10 independent blocks, you would have a probability of 0.36 for this to occur by chance. So this case where you get very high false discovery proportions is actually not a very rare situation. This can occur actually quite frequently. So here, as I promised you, p-values under drift sampling and sequencing. So the authors of the paper we talked about were so kind to provide us with their actual data. So we tried to reanalyze the data doing it the correct way. And this is now just for the selected replicate lines. And this is now our method. And these on the right side, you see again the original paper, original p-values. What you see is that the p-values got much smaller. Here they ranged these log 10 p-values between 0 and 40. Here, you should be careful if you match it. The x here is to the left, whereas here it's to the right. So if you match a region, see, you're matching the correct one. Yeah, thanks for pointing this out. So in general, the p-values got much smaller, which is maybe not surprising because we are taking also the drift noise into account and sampling noise. What's maybe good news is that you get still significant results, or let's rather say you would not get really much significant if you would stick with the Bonferroni correction and type alpha probability of 1/1,000,000, because then you would have to cut up at 12 and you would not see very much. These lines are cut off you would get with false discovery rate Benjamini-Hochberg, so the depend on the p-values and are not exactly the same across replicates. What you can also see is that the range of p-values does not change very much anymore across replicates. So basically, you are more or less at the same level. So we discussed this is was an artifact coming from the different sequencing coverage, which is maybe nice. And so anyway, that's what you get with this reanalysis of the data. And maybe I skip this part on detecting selection from time series data, because we did a recent paper Christian also mentioned with Thomas Taus and Christian, where we developed estimates of the selection coefficient plus testing for selection if you not just have two time points but whole time series data. Which works reasonably well, we argue. Then we, but there are other approaches also to do this work with time series data. For instance, beta binomial Gaussian processes, where Caroline participated in. There is a likelihood ratio test with Gaussian processes, composite likelihood, evolve and resequence, ABC, if you like the simulation-based approach, and there would be simple approaches, just neglecting the whole time series and just take first and last time points. And we could use sign test as a very simple method, but also CMH test, Fisher's exact test, and chi-square test. And so one question we ask ourselves, do the more complex methods pay off? And we did some simulations with a master student, and actually it seems to turn out sometimes, but not always. So the red one is the sign test, so you just at each between two time points, you just check whether you are going up or down and just disregard the amount. So you can use this test without having any information about NE or so. So this is actually fairly simple, an information which is necessary for the other methods actually. And the green one is CMH test, the light blue is this clear, and our method is LLS, has a similar performance as CLEAR actually. And what you can see is that the red one, the sign test, performs pretty well in some cases. Well, sometimes you have a little bit less power, but in general, you're doing not so badly. Maybe here it's not as good. So on what does this difference depend? Well, it's clear that the sign test will only be powerful if you have enough signals, so means you need enough replicates and or enough time points where you did the sequencing, because each new time point gives you a new piece of information of whether you are going up or down. And if you have too few of this, this sign test will be just too coarse, but if you have enough of them, there seems to be actually not so much difference in power. So, and then maybe as the last thing to mention, as we discussed before, what should we do if the effect is not present in all of our replicates? So sometimes you see it in some, but not other. And of course, there might be valid reasons for this. Maybe if the initial allele frequency is low, it might have gone lost by drift or something like this. So there are reasons to expect why sometimes the signal is not consistent. And of course, there are different approaches you could deal with this. But if you just look, take the Cochran-Mantel-Hensel or CMH test, and combine the data across all of the replicates, if your signal is not consistent, the problem is that you will lose power, because those replicates that showed no signal will dilute your signal, and at the end you have less signal or so. So our approach we are proposing here is to use individual tests for the replicates and combine the p-values. That's actually an approach known in statistics as testing the global null hypothesis. So the global null hypothesis means all of the null hypothesis is true, and you want to check whether all of my null hypotheses are true, or the alternative is true at least in some cases, so mean no signal at all, or a signal at least in some of my replicates, but maybe not in all of my replicates. And if you look at classical methods for testing the global null hypothesis, there's one going back to Fisher's combination test. Take just the logarithm of the p-value, multiply by 2, sum it up, multiply by -1, and this gives you something chi-square distributed under the null model, at least if all of our if the p-values are uniformly distributed under the null hypothesis. A similar idea is the Stauffer test, which takes the inverse normal distribution instead of the logarithm. Bonferroni would also work here. Just take the smallest p-value, and if it's smaller than alpha over m, then this means that not all of our null hypotheses can be true, and there's a slight improvement of this Bonferroni test, which is called sine test. And finally, I want to mention a rather new fancy method called higher criticism. This term goes back to a well-known statistician, Tukey, who basically borrowed this term from biblical science, but he used it to say, okay, if you basic idea is, if I test 100 hypotheses at level alpha, and if I get 5 rejections, that's nothing unusual, because that's something I would get by chance. So, and from this idea, the following test idea resulted. I just take the number of p-values falling below a certain threshold alpha, and combine this with the expected number. Okay, so alpha minus the observed proportion, and if this difference is large, then this would give evidence against the null hypothesis, and if it's small, then this would be nothing unusual. But then the question is, which alpha should I take? Should I take 0.05? Should I take 0.01? At which difference should I look? So, and then the idea is, just look at all differences simultaneously, so take the maximum from between 1 and alpha 0 m. So maybe you care until a significance level of 0.3 or 0.5 or whatever you choose. And then look at the maximum of these distances. And basically, this is the correct normalization. And you can find an approx. If now you have many, many hypotheses you test, you could approximate this by a Gaussian process. In principle, this is related to the quantile process, or time of experimental process. But if m is small, you can simulate this. And I mean, this was a method proposed like a couple of years ago, and I included it because it's fancy. And we also developed a test with the idea that we want to have good power no matter how many null hypotheses are not true. So these ones, Bonferroni works well if the alternative holds in few cases. These work well if you have small signals, but they are consistent across replicates. So we want to have something which has good performance overall. For this, we sorted all our p-values, transformed them with a function h, for instance, the logarithm, the negative logarithm, summed up these transformed p-values, then we measured how unusual they are. So basically, GI is the distribution function of these cores SI in the case we are in the global null hypothesis. So this measures the evidence against the global null hypothesis. And then we consider all these partial sums simultaneously and take as test statistic the partial sum which gives us the maximum evidence. So it's maybe plausible, and then we did some simulations, and with our test you could look at different scenarios. For instance, the alternative is true in one case, in three cases. On the next slide you have also five cases and 10 cases if you have either 10 hypotheses you test or 20 hypotheses to test. So our test is the black solid line, the dashed one is Bonferroni, and the light black one is the Fisher test, or the gray one is the Fisher test. And if you see if the null hypothesis is false just in one case, we are slightly worse than the Bonferroni, but much better than Fisher. And if the alternative holds, say, in many cases, we are slightly worse than Fisher, but much better than Bonferroni. So it's sort of, we are never the best, but we have a good overall performance. So that was our intention. If you look at the minimax power, which is the smallest power across all cases, numbers of alternatives to be true, to make this a fair comparison, we have to sort of normalize that these cases in sum contain the same sort of the same amount of signal, but distributed among different numbers of alternatives. And it seems that our test gives the best worst case performance in this sense. So it's and even if you have distributed effect sizes, sometimes we're even better. And we applied, this is my last slide, this test now to our data set. And what you see, actually combining the information across all of our replicates gives you a much larger number of significant results again. So whatever you make out of this, so you get, I mean, it's still, I think, 1 out of 1,000 SNPs are significant, but still, if you have millions of SNPs, there remains quite a bit of significant things. And compare it maybe to the case where we want to look for maximum reproducibility. So I took the maximum p-value over all replicates. So basically took this replicate where the signal was weakest or estimated to be weakest to get the largest p-value from our test. And you see you get still some significant results. So these are probably the consistent results across all your replicates. Quite a bit fewer than if you look also at results that seem to show up only in a few replicates. So as I'm coming from the statistics side, of course I would be interested in your input if this makes sense from a biological side, or would be helpful from a biological side. But anyway, maybe I will stop here, and maybe you still have questions or so.
So they made a claim of convergence, that their data are still largely convergent. Did you check whether the kind of convergence signals that they've pulled out are also found when you look for your most reproducible ones? I think they came up with some Go categories, etc., that showed convergence. So
well, I did not check them against the Go categories yet, so I would assume that we would get the same convergent results, but I didn't check it, so I cannot tell you.
Something like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some over-representation in some Go categories. Mm-hmm.
All right, we have no talk at 11. We have a talk later this afternoon.